special session for the Master's Seminary with the ministry of the Banner of Truth. This is a wonderful ministry that I want you to be very aware of. When I was where you are, when I was a student in seminary, I was very unfamiliar with church history, very unfamiliar with Reformed theology, very unfamiliar with the sovereignty of God in all things. And I remember walking into the seminary bookstore and finding some Banner of Truth books, and out of curiosity, pulling them off the shelf and buying them, taking them home. I lived by myself. I was a single young man, and just reading these Banner of Truth books. And in the course of my exposure to the Banner of Truth books, my entire theology, my entire worldview was radically and dramatically changed. So much so, and I say this not humorously, but it was almost as if I was saved all over again, because I came to understand the greatness of our God in salvation as well as in the affairs of providence. And so I could only pray for you that during your time here at Master's Seminary, that you would have such an awakening as well to high theology and the grand doctrines of the Christian faith, which I know you are already being exposed to in your classes. But books have a very special ministry. At times can go beyond a professor, because you cannot take your professor home with you. But you can take that book with you, and that book is a companion, and you can read it at your own pace, and it is accessible to you. I was recently, or maybe a couple of years ago, at a Ligonier conference, and I was in a Q&A, and Dr. Sinclair Ferguson was on the panel. I was there, R.C. Sproul, and we were asked the question, name the three greatest books that you've ever read in your life. I said Body of Divinity, which I think was either the first or the second book that the Banner published. I said Forgotten Spurgeon by the man sitting on the front row, and the biography of George Whitefield by Arnold Dallimore. I would still hold that those three books have most shaped my life outside of the Bible itself. And I remember Sinclair saying to me, you know, all three of those books are Banner titles. And I really had not even thought about it. And so the debt of gratitude that I owe to these brothers in Scotland who have been carrying on their work there in a distant land, but those books have made their way here to the States. I was visiting not long ago with the widow of James Montgomery Boyce, Linda Boyce, and we were talking about the resurgence of Reformed truth here in the States. And we talked about the ministry of James Montgomery Boyce, and it was books by the Banner of Truth that he began to teach in a small group Bible study that eventually gave rise to the Philadelphia Conference on Reformed Theology. I think you can trace back the influence of this resurgence in the sovereignty of God in salvation. I think you can trace it back to the influence and ministry of the Banner of Truth as those books have made their way across the ocean. I want to introduce some of the key men who have come to be with you today, and I will turn the program over to them, but I know that you will give them your utmost attention. I want to introduce the first, the three trustees who are here, begin with one of the founding trustees, Ian Murray. His books, I know, have had a great influence on your life. His two-volume on Martin Lloyd-Jones, I think, is a must-read for every pastor to shape your understanding of biblical ministry. And what a privilege it is for us to have Ian Murray with us here this morning. Sinclair Ferguson, who is the chairman of the trustees, is, I think, a national treasure for Scotland. He's been on loan to the States. teaching at Westminster, and he flies over three times a year to teach at Redeemer Seminary in Dallas. He has now returned back to Scotland, where he lives in Carnoustie, but his extended ministry through preaching and through his books is extraordinary, and I think in many ways the most respected visible figure in all of Scotland in the evangelical circles. And then Ian Hamilton is with us, who ministers in Cambridge, England. He is the pastor of Cambridge Presbyterian Church. I had the joy of meeting him, I guess it was the summer before last, as I was in Cambridge with Sinclair. Or I guess Sinclair had already returned, but we were there on a church history tour. He was so gracious and kind and had the privilege of speaking with him at a Banner of Truth pastors' conference this past summer. So these three distinguished trustees from the Banner are here. Also here is John Rawlinston, who is the office manager and more than office, just manager, period, of the internal affairs of the Banner of Truth. He was very gracious to me one day and gave me a cook's tour of the office, and I felt like I had gone to the Scottish Holy Land just to walk through the office of the Banner. I was hugging manuscripts of A.W. Pink and all the like. So, and then also Jonathan Watson is here, who is an editor with the Banner of Truth and wonderfully used. I would commend to you their magazine as well, that Jonathan is the editor of that. So I've taken up enough time. You want to hear from these men, but I'm so glad that you're here, and I want to encourage you, as you buy books while you're here in seminary, buy books that will influence your life for the rest of your life. And when you pick up a Banner of Truth book, more than likely it will be one of those books that will be pivotal in your understanding of who God is and how His ministry is to be conducted. So, as I turn it over, do I turn it over to Sinclair B. Ferguson, Ian Hamilton? Okay. Well, would you please give a warm greeting to Ian Hamilton from Cambridge?
I'm the youngest of the three trustees who are here, just in case you're wondering. My first encounter with Banner of Truth books was in early 1969. I'd not long become a Christian in a dispensational Baptist church, just a Christian church to me. I had no Christian background. And I happened to say to some of the deacons in that church that I'd found something very wonderful in the Bible. And it was that God had chosen me before I had chosen him. One of the deacons immediately said, "That's Calvinism." And I had no idea what Calvinism was. And I simply said, "No, I found it in Romans 8. And the following week, an older fellow, probably in his early 20s, came up to me with a book. It was Robert Haldane's commentary on Romans that the Banner had published. He said, "I think you might appreciate this." And I looked, didn't read the whole volume, but I dipped into it, and I thought, this is exactly what the Bible teaches. That was my first encounter with Banner books, and from that moment, they literally shaped my whole Christian life. If I had the opportunity, I would want to tell you about John Murray's Redemption, Accomplished and Applied, but that's not one of the five books I've been given. So, first of all, Biblical Theology by Johannes Gerhardus Voss. Let me just read briefly from the flyleaf. The aim of this book is no less than to provide an account of the unfolding of the mind of God in history through the successive agents of his special revelation. Voss handles this under three main divisions: the Mosaic Epoch of Revelation, the Prophetic Epoch of Revelation, and the New Testament. This was a seminal book in my young Christian life. It helped me to understand that systematic theology must rest on biblical theology and be absolutely consonant with biblical theology. And through the history of redemption, Voss traces the unfolding of God's saving purposes. And this was a tremendous eye-opener to me. This was one of the early books that I read, probably in the early 1970s. And it struck me with great force, I think, and has helped me ever since to keep in the forefront of my mind the absolute significance of the unfolding, developing, deepening revelation of God throughout the successive epochs of redemptive history, and to keep my understanding of systematic theology deeply rooted in biblical theology. So, Gerhardus Voss, it's really a must-read, as all of these books are. Revival and Revivalism, The Making and Marring of American Evangelicalism, 1750 to 1858, one of the most significant centuries in the history of the Christian Church, written, of course, by Ian H. Murray. Ian writes church history as no one else writes church history, but it's church history that deftly has woven through it rich biblical and systematic theology. You need to be aware of the profound difference between revival, a true work of God, and revivalism, a mere construction of man to look like a work of God. And Ian does this in a very compelling way. Recently, I was told that a Christian was walking through the streets of Beijing and he was passing a large bookshop and he saw this book in the front window of the bookshop in Beijing. So it's getting everywhere. But revival and revivalism, an understanding of church history is absolutely imperative, I think, for pastoral preaching. It helps us to understand perspective. It makes us aware that the issues that people think are red-hot button issues today are actually issues that have surfaced in the life of the church in the past. And this was actually an unputdownable read for me, if I remember rightly, when I first came across it. Archibald Brown, Spurgeon's successor, again by Ian H. Murray, a very recent biography. Archibald Brown was a younger contemporary of Charles Haddon Spurgeon. He ministered in one of the poorest areas of London. He ministered at a time when evangelicalism was being transformed into an evangelicalism that aped the culture of the day. But Brown steadfastly resisted the temptation to bring amusement into the life of the church. He was absolutely convinced that the preaching of the Word of God in the power of the Spirit of God was the need for the hour. And to see that worked out in a ministry that saw God's blessing, the congregation he served in the main grew and grew. But to see that conviction, resisting the temptation to go with the flow, resisting the temptation to bring the world into the life of the church in the hope that thereby you will influence the world, you never ever do. It's the world that influences the church. And again, there are books that you read and enjoy. This for me was a very enjoyable, as well as a challenging read. So let me warmly commend that to you. This is the Ian Murray day. So I've been given these books. Ian Murray, a new biography. Well, it was 20 or so years ago. Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards was one of England's greatest theologians. Americans would like to claim him, but he was an English patrician, and he would have resisted the revolution if he had lived that long. The life of Edwards is a remarkable life. He was a towering genius, of course. And his life was marked by incident. It was marked by trial, controversy. But through it all shines the heart of a man devoted to Christ, devoted to the word of Christ, and devoted to the people of Christ, which ultimately cost him his pastorate in Northampton, Massachusetts. Edwards is an example to us of an unyieldingly, undeviatingly faithful Christian pastor. He was probably a diameter removed from most of us here this morning in terms of his intellectual capacities, but he was just an astonishing man. And when I first read this, again, this is not, I hope, flattering Ian, but it's more commending Edwards. It was a gripping read, an absolutely gripping read. And please do not leave this conference without Edwards. The second Banner of Truth book that I read, Haldane on Romans was the first. I just read parts of it. The first that I read through beginning to end was John G. Payton, the autobiography of the pioneer missionary to the New Hebrides, now called Vanuatu. I was a young Christian, no background in Christianity, no background in the Christian church. I read this almost with disbelief that there could be people who actually lived such Christian lives in the world. He was a Scotsman, so he has that in his favour. But he was a man devoted to Christ, who expended his life in the cause of Christ. And I just found this a read that made me search my own heart and ask myself, is this kind of devotion a devotion that in any way approximates your devotion? 5 books, please seriously consider buying them, and even more importantly, reading them. Ian Murray.
Good morning, men. When Dr. Lloyd-Jones was dying, he said his great hope was that if God used his works at all, it would be to help young men who were preparing for the ministry. And it's a wonderful fact that they have been greatly used. I think more men are reading Lloyd-Jones now than they were in his lifetime. So I've been given a few books too, and the first is 14 volumes of Lloyd-Jones on Romans. He started preaching on Romans after he'd been in the ministry for 30 years. That's important, not when he started, but 30 years later. He started in 1957 and he concluded in 1968. And he had got at that point to not quite to the end of chapter 14 of Romans. And then these volumes came out. And how 14 volumes? Well, most of you know it's not because he quotes a lot from Professor Whatnot and Doctor This, That. He doesn't do anything like that. Paul was writing to ordinary men and women, Christian men and women in Rome, and the Lloyd-Jones volumes are for Christians. And if they have a spiritual appetite, no matter what their intellectual background is, these are wonderful volumes. The thread really is that our supreme need as Christians is for the knowledge of God, and that theology is speech about God. And it's that that runs through the whole. Now, remember, why 14 volumes? Well, Paul says at the beginning, he's speaking about the gospel of God, which he promised aforetime in the Holy Scriptures. Romans really is the summary of a whole body of truth. If we really have the book of Romans in our minds and hearts, we have got a grip on the whole Bible. So people who say, well, how did he take so long? They don't really understand what Romans means. It's just the book that we need day by day. Doctrine of God, everything flows from that. What's the problem with reaching unbelievers? The problem is not that we have to find some way to interest them and attract them. We don't have to do that. We have a witness on our side in their hearts. The work of the law is written on the hearts of every natural man and woman. And our business is to speak of God and the law of God in such a way as people are brought to conviction of sin. And if there's anything we need in our current world, it's conviction of sin. And conviction comes by the law. And the law doesn't just mean of preaching Ten Commandments, of course. It means a whole body of truth. Look at Lloyd-Jones doing that. Just this volume one on Romans. It's a tremendous volume on evangelism. What is evangelism? It's not just getting people to realize they need forgiveness. It involves rebirth, regeneration. What are the marks of a regenerate person? How do you distinguish between that and a nominal Christian? Lloyd-Jones is a wonderful guide on that whole area. Now, that's a sort of expository series, and then this is the book, Old Testament Evangelistic Sermons by Lloyd-Jones, in quite a different vein. He believed that every week, every church should have one evangelistic sermon, and he did that himself. So one part of the week he might be teaching Romans, other parts of the week, a pointed sermon directed to the non-Christian. And here's an example of how he did it. These are all from the Old Testament, examples of how the Old Testament can be made so applicable to people today that Ahab and all these Old Testament characters, they're alive in the world today. Human nature hasn't changed one little bit, and he lifts up the Old Testament and brings home to men and women. Scores of people were converted. He was primarily, really, an evangelist. Well, do look at that book. Now then, Spurgeon's Lectures to My Students. It's really four volumes. One of them is called Commenting and Commentaries. You may know that. And let me put it like this. Supposing Spurgeon was alive, and you could go to his house in Westwood in South London, and he'd take you round this marvelous library that he had. And he'd say to you, you don't need that book, but this one you must have. And then what is it? This book. Well, this is what he does here. He takes you round his library in Commenting and Commentaries, 1,400 books. He tells you what are the best books, what are helpful, and then he tells you a third-rate book they're good for housemaids to light fires with and so on. Well, of course, he's only commenting on books up until the middle of the 1870s, but it's an amazing fact how many of the best books from his list are in print today. So Commenting and Commentaries is a must for ministers. When we were young men, we virtually slept with it underneath our pillows. It's an invaluable book. It won't save you wasting time, lead you to the best things. Good. Now, as well as that, there are three other books of lectures. And you know, on Friday afternoons in his college, he would sit down behind a table, comparatively small room, and he'd just talk to the students and give them all kinds of practical wisdom. What should we be like in as pastors? Well, we should be sociable, he says, and then he'd illustrate what he meant by that. We should be cheerful. Let me give you a little word on that. He says, certain monks that I saw in Rome who salute one another in tones like the sepulchre and convey the pleasant information, brother, we must die. To which lively salutation, each lively brother of the other order replies, yes, brother, we must die. I was glad to be assured upon such good authority that all these lazy fellows are about to die. Upon the whole, it is the best thing they could do. Well, some people have the wrong idea that Spurgeon was funny in the pulpit. He wasn't, but he could be funny. And if you ever feel a bit like a little cheerfulness, well, dip into this volume. How should we just spend our time? Well, he says, the minister's always on duty. Never forget that. That doesn't mean we don't need to relax. Oh, yes, he says we do. And he says things like, it's better to be industriously asleep than to be half awake when you're alive or living. All sorts of things. It's his own experience is packed in, and all his reading and biographies. It's just an endless book. I hope none of you will be cast upon a desert island, but if you ever were, be sure to take this volume with you. Now, 2 minutes, thank you. Prayer by Eric Alexander. When we come to the end of our lives, you know, we best of men have regrets. And some regrets we don't read enough, we haven't studied the Bible enough. But the most common regret is for pastors, we haven't prayed enough. And that's true. Prayer is to do with the knowledge of God. It's the fountain from which everything else comes. This is a very helpful small book by Eric Alexander, which I do warmly commend to you. Eric is still alive. Dr. MacArthur has said he is one of the most helpful preachers I've ever had here. His health isn't strong now, but read him on prayer, a biblical perspective. Thank you, men. Good to see you all.
I read a book when I was a very young man saying, you should never thank people for coming to church. And I think it was a wise word. God doesn't say, I'm so grateful to you for coming to see me. But this is not church. So thank you. Thank you for braving this. I mean, to me, it seems you have braved this traffic. But to you, it's really just normal life, I'm sure. And probably some of you have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning in order to get to a 9 o'clock class. So I speak for all of us. We are both grateful and moved that you should come. And I'm sure there is no ulterior motive for you coming. I don't think there is any increase in the GPA for coming, although I hope to be able to offer some inducement to you in a few minutes' time. Banner of Truth Books. Each of us is a man under authority, and our general manager, John Rawlinson, has told us the books that we are to commend to you. I should say, since the three of us actually are Scottish, you should not read anything into the fact that we are Scots and we are wanting you to buy particular books. You might have the impression those must be the books that aren't selling. But in fact, those are the books that are selling, and we just would like you to understand their value. And before I mention the books I've been given, let me just add a word, which is like a cat looking at a king or a president, if that's what you have, about Dr. Lloyd-Jones' evangelistic sermons. I first heard of Dr. Lloyd-Jones through a young couple I knew who were courting. And I remember the girl told me that she was being taken by her beloved to hear Dr. Lloyd-Jones preaching in Glasgow, which was my home city and Ian Hamilton's home city. We were brought up within about 3 miles of each other. And he is, of course, younger than I am. And I saw this girl the next day, and I said, well, what was it like? She said, well, he preached on the destruction of Dagon, and I thought the building was going to collapse. And I remember thinking, I was 15, I think, at the time, next time I have got to hear this man. And so I heard him every couple of years, and everybody would say, we love Dr. Lloyd-Jones coming because he gives such deep teaching. So that was the phrase, he gives such deep teaching to us. And then when the books started coming out, I realized what Dr. Lloyd-Jones had been doing was re-preaching his Sunday night evangelistic messages. And it was like a door opening to me that it was possible to expound the scriptures in such a way that the sheep would be fed and sinners would be converted. And it was a hugely important lesson to me. Because we live in a culture where those two things have tended to be divorced from one another. You're either preaching the gospel or you're preaching the Bible. And Lloyd-Jones was such a terrific illustration of the fact that we can simultaneously feed the sheep and speak to those who are not yet converted. That was something that the 17th century Puritans did with great power. And I want to recommend to you three of our Puritan paperback series. Not every Puritan book that the Banner publishes comes in six volumes, or in the case of the 23 volumes that we publish of John Owen. And very early on in the story of the Trust's work, the decision was made to pick out some of the very best of individual Puritan volumes and to make them accessible and readable, not just for the kind of people that can struggle through Gerhardus Voss, but the kind of people to whom the Puritans preached and for whom the Puritans wrote. And three of them in particular I want to recommend to you. The first is the shortest of the three and perhaps the most famous of the three, Richard Sibbes' little book, The Bruised Reed. If you were present when Alistair Begg was speaking the other day, he actually referred to Richard Sibbes in that little poem that he quoted of that blessed man, let this just praise be given, that heaven was in him before he was in heaven. And Richard Sibbes was truly a pastor of the heart. Every congregation, actually every theological seminary, has every type of character and every kind of spiritual experience. And in pastoral ministry, perhaps increasingly today, we are constantly encountering Christians who are bruised reeds. And Sibbes picks up the words of the servant's song that are used of the Lord Jesus in Matthew's Gospel and expounds them in a way that has been hugely helpful to centuries of Christians. I think it's impossible to read this book without being spiritually nourished. And those of you who know the story of Dr. Lloyd-Jones, in fact, it's quoted here on the back, I shall never cease to be grateful to Richard Sibbes, who was balm to my soul at a period in my life when I was overworked and badly overtired, and therefore subject in an unusual manner to the onslaughts of the devil. And Dr. Lloyd-Jones gives testimony to the rich value of the bruised reed. And the price isn't on the back, but it can't be too much, since it's A, a Banner book, and B, it's a paperback. I won't mention his name, but all of you know his name. He is undoubtedly one of the best-known preachers in our circles and beyond our circles in the United States. He's somebody I've known for many years. And he told me, just in course of a conversation one day, that before he went out pastoral visiting any day during his ministry, he would pick up this little book by Thomas Brooks, which has been extracted from the six-volume set of the works of Thomas Brooks, which are still in print and worthy of purchase. And he would look through this book, Precious Remedies Against Satan's Devices, with the question in view, I wonder which of these devices I'm going to encounter this afternoon and this evening. Now, that in every home he would visit, he would be sure that Satan was either trying to keep someone out of the kingdom, or he was trying to mar the joy or steal the assurance of a true believer who was in the kingdom. And in a way, when you open this book, do not be put off by the contents pages. Most books, you know, try and get the contents into one page. The contents pages in this particular book take up 10 pages. But hugely helpful because it's a kind of index to the book in advance. And it's very easy to look and see the different ways in which Brooks analyzes the work of Satan. You know, throughout my Christian life, I think one of the most frequently cited texts whenever Satan has been mentioned has been, "We are not ignorant of his devices." But the truth of the matter is we are. We are hugely ignorant of his devices. And this book should be your first port of call in thinking about the work of the evil one. And that is hugely important, isn't it, in our pastoral ministry. It's also hugely important in our pastoral counseling to have some sense of the different strategies of Satan. He is not omnipotent, and he is not omniscient, and he's not omnicompetent. He has only so many strategies. And it's incumbent upon us to be able to have a sense of the strategy he may be using in somebody's life without them knowing. The truth of the matter is that if they go to the average Christian counselor, this is not going to be any part of the analysis or the pastoral care, but it needs to be in our ministry too. And then this lovely book. You know, don't you find that as our society collapses, there's such an increase among conservative Christians of the complaining spirit, and we mimic and mirror the world in the way in which we respond to the world. It's a kind of unusual thing to feel a sense of excitement and stimulus that we're actually living more and more in a time that feels like the New Testament, and that there the gospel prevailed. And while, for example, in the New Testament you see these rigorous analyses of the reason for the corruption in the world, you also see this tremendous sense of the contentment that we find in Jesus Christ. Interestingly, Jeremiah Burroughs called it the rare jewel of Christian contentment, which means, if I may say so, you therefore, by simple logic, ought to be able to sell a lot of copies of this book to your congregation if it really is a rare jewel. And incidentally, that's a great thing to do. I shouldn't say this, but after all, I'm a trustee. If you are in a church and you want to introduce a book of the month, first time I was here, Dr. MacArthur lifted up a book that I had written. It was a banner book, and whatever pastor was sitting beside me leaned over. He said, "There goes another 1,000 copies of your book sold." It wasn't quite true. It was only 999, and I've never really forgiven him. It is amazing how much our people trust us when it comes to books. And that's understandable because they don't know what to read. You know, 98% of, quotes, Christian books are published by evangelicals. And people do need guidance. And if it's still true, my view, it's true among theological students, that contentment is a rare jewel. And if that's still true in your congregation, Banner will give you a really good deal, so that they, your congregation, not only get a good book, but they get a good deal. And I think you will find the usefulness of these books when you introduce them to people will take you by surprise, really take you by surprise. So these three books, one other book, The Institutes of the Christian Religion. I'm sure it's a prescribed text at Master Seminary. Is it a prescribed text at Master Seminary? Good, it's a but this isn't a prescribed text at Master Seminary. And the reason for that is that this is the 1541 edition, French edition of the Institute's translated into very fine English by a very, very competent scholar and translator. And one of the values of the 1541 edition is that it represents Calvin as a fully blossomed thinker and theologian. You know, 1536, the first edition, was just six chapters, originally written when he was 26 years old. So he was younger, probably, than most of the people in this room when he first wrote the Institutes. And he kept working at it, and it grew. And this 1541 edition, you might say, is the real flowering of his work. It's not as long, obviously, as the 1559 final edition, 1560 French edition. But this is a beautiful book to read. Banner books, hardbacks, are made to last, physically made to last, at least 100 years. So when you buy this one, you could write in it to your great-grandson, "This is one of the best books I ever read." So books that are built to last. Want to commend to you also, if you haven't read it, I imagine this is a book that's on your list, Charles Bridges' The Christian Ministry. Possibly the last great comprehensive work on the Christian ministry written by one individual. He was an Anglican minister. When you read it, you won't hold that against him. It is an outstandingly sane book on every aspect of pastoral ministry. We have a couple of books we'd like you to take away with you. And there are copies, I hope, for all at the back. A new edition of J.C. Ryle's Holiness. I'm sure that's a book that has been commended to you again and again. But this actually is the best edition of Ryle's Holiness for several reasons. One is because the quality of the actual book itself is superior. It's been completely reset. We want you to have a copy of J.C. Ryle's book on holiness. Remember McShane's words that a holy minister is an awful weapon in the hands of God. And ministers are not actually, as far as I can tell, known for holiness these days. Known for lots of things, but not so much known for holiness. So this, which is for the people of God in general, has a very special message to gospel ministers. And one of our trustees, Ted Donnelly, has written this beautiful book on Peter, Eyewitness of His Majesty. It is a beautiful illustration of what quality expository ministry looks like. Sorry that Ted is not able to be here. If any of you can listen to him, anywhere you can find him on the web, you will luxuriate in Ted's ministry. And so this is A, a beautiful book, and B, it's a wonderful illustration of what real biblical ministry looks like. So thank you for coming. John says if you have any questions, then please fire away. Any questions about anything? Sir? Yes, they are. John, I think probably you'd be the best person to answer that.
Yes, the answer is yes. You can get them off our website on either EPUB or Kindle from the website. Not everything. We're in the process of going through things, and it will take us a number of years, in fact, to work right through our backlist. We've got 700-800 books in print. But with new books that we're doing now, the aim is to simultaneously publish in original print, and also as ebooks.
John, I should ask, when will the next ebook sale be? I know there was one that crashed the site, but is there another one? I mean, I'm on their side financially.
Yeah, we did indeed crash our website. I think it was Black Monday, and we put all our ebooks up at crazy prices. We're not planning on doing that again right now. But there will be periods of time, if you're not on our email list, then I'd encourage you to go to our website, sign up onto our email list, and you will get information from us, both on new books and occasionally we're running special offers and so on. So do feel free to sign up.
I only mention that because someone who was in the book trade in the UK said to me the difference between the charismatic and the reformed is that the charismatic will buy the book at any price, whereas the reformed want a discount. I'm just passing on information I heard from somebody. There was another question. Yes, sir. John, are they all in print?
Yeah, they are all available. Obviously, things cycle through, and there are occasions when you might find a particular volume is unavailable for a few weeks or a month or two. But in principle, they're all available, and we keep them in print.
Good. And yes. Great. That we take that to heart, and it might not be a bad idea if you sent us a list of the banner books we have that you thought might be particularly helpful. Great. Yes, if you talk to John afterwards, that would be great. Anything else? It's your chance to know all the hidden details about Dr. Lloyd-Jones. Well, who should be? Ian, you should be first. Right. The question is asking for counsel about building into the busyness of ministry the discipline of reading and how to go about that, and presumably what kind of things to read as well.
Well, that's a very good question, isn't it? It's priorities, really. I think that the main problem in the Christian ministry is the right use of your time and to have a control on your time. So while we need to be approachable so people can get access to us, we shouldn't be accessible all the time because other people will soon make up your life for you. So there needs to be some real discipline and times when we're not available to anyone. That's an absolute priority. Then I think the you'd be reading books that are going to help you for preaching and pastoral work, and you'll soon find out what those books are, I think. We haven't time for luxuries. We don't want to waste time. Time is very precious. And then retaining what you read is vital. I find now I get great help from notes I took 40 or 50 years ago. So if a thing is worth reading, it's worth remembering it. So you have to have some system of retrieval that you're going to know what you've read and be able to turn it up and go back to it maybe years on. Come on, Sinclair, tell them more.
Well, I can add to that because I have occasionally borrowed books from Ian Murray. You know, some of us are super organized, so it's our default to put it on a spreadsheet or something, you know. Some of us are more chaos-oriented. And what Ian does, which is so simple but so helpful, is, you know, it's difficult to remember what page, but it's not so difficult to remember what book. And every book I have borrowed from him that he has read has had the Murray Index, as well as any other index there might be already printed in the book, of the things that have struck him as being particularly helpful. And I imagine that's part of the key to why it is when you read Ian's books, you think, you know, how could he remember where all these quotations were? And my suspicion is he didn't remember where the quotations were, except some of them, left-hand page between 109 and 150. But he remembered the book they were in, and so he was able to find them. And that's a very simple discipline. I think one thing I would say is, when you begin ministry, there's a tremendous temptation to read every commentary you can put your hands on. And I usually say to people, at most, get three. First of all, get one that you know is just classical and solid. Two, if you've got the money for it, get the latest good one, because the three previous good ones are by and large included in that latest one. And you save yourself both time and money. I mean, in some ways, I kind of despise this fact that scholars are writing for scholars and not for ministers when they're writing commentaries. But that is a good principle, I think, to be able to use contemporary evangelical scholarship. And I think the third principle there is that under the pressure of preaching, I would say don't spend more time than you need in that element of it. And whatever you're preaching on, read around the theme, the doctrine, the pastoral application that you may be interested in. And that way, without deviating from your regular preaching, you build up, you're a squirrel collecting nuts for the winter, and the winter will come. But if you just stick to exclusively reading about the text you're preaching on, I think you find yourself really under the cosh. And then the other thing is to make even a little time each week, make a little time that is sacrosanct for concentrated reading of serious books. That could be one particular writer that's really helpful to you, a Puritan set. It could be a doctrine. But build that in. John Stott had, I think, quite a sensible way of doing that. So many hours a week, then a day a month, and a week a year that was, in a busy ministry, relatively manageable. Because it's a long-term business if the Lord doesn't return and we minister for many years. Ian, do you want to add something? Good question. Yes? Right. Ian, the question is about special friendships within the congregation for the minister.
Yeah, the reference was to the Lloyd-Jones' book on preachers and preaching, and there's a lot of practical wisdom thrown in, and that's one of them. The thing that struck people who knew Lloyd-Jones and the work of his church was how exceedingly kind he was to people that were a real nuisance. It's a fact that, I mean, in every congregation there are people that are awkward or make difficulties or critical. It's amazing how kind he was to them. He just tried to overcome them with affection, and often it was blessed, but it's really... It's not the way we naturally react. I was going to say something else, what was that? But anyway.
Question is, should a minister have a special...
In a congregation.
...brother in the congregation?
No, people soon spot that. or if the minister's wife has a few clique friends in a congregation, they soon spot that. So, no, it's better not to. It's certain to be open to all, and there will be certain friendships, but they shouldn't be obvious, should they? That's that about right? And that, I forgot, one of Spurgeon's rules are every minister should have one blind eye and one deaf ear. That's one of his important. There are certain things you're not to hear. Don't listen to tale-bearing. Don't listen to what Pastor so-and-so did in the congregation before you came. You've got to have a deaf ear and a blind eye. So you're, and it's good advice, isn't it? If we listen to everything. It was said of Mrs. Lloyd-Jones, people asked her what was her main role. She said, one of them is to stop my husband hearing certain things. Well, it's quite important, you know.
Ian, thank do you want you. To?
No, I guess I might differ from what you said, so I'll keep quiet.
So you ask Ian Hamilton privately in the confessional box. You know, I think if you're a minister where there are several ministers, it's really important to the congregation that they understand that you are mutually affectionate brothers to one another. Because when they see the reverse, it spreads throughout the congregation. And when they see that, almost by osmosis, they pick up that's the way the Christian life should be lived. And the same with your elders, you know, that or whatever they're called, that I think you should have in view that within however long, it will be clear to the congregation that this leadership group is a group of men who have great affection for one another, give place to one another's gifts, and admire the grace of God in those gifts. And in that way, you instead of having one best friend, best friends, I think, then tends to spread throughout the whole congregation. Because it is, to me anyway, it's amazing how much you can bond with people with whom you don't spend a great deal of time, partly because you're pouring yourself into them when you're pouring the Word of God into them. And you become their, in many ways, their best friend. It's a kind of frightening thought, but I think it really is. The number of people who must have thought of Spurgeon, to whom they had rarely spoken as, you know, the most influential person in their lives, must have been colossal. Well, our time is gone. John, you have some words?